Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have John Forrest Dolan on the show. John is the Chief Executive Officer and Zoo Director of the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. Born and raised in California, John received his BA in Biology from Humboldt State and a Master's in Architecture from Parsons School of Design. He worked for the Wildlife Conservation Society at the Bronx Zoo as an exhibit designer and in construction management before becoming the director of the New York City Aquarium in 2008. John was so much fun to talk to, and I learned so much from him. Let's go meet him, and Baker will take us there.
To infiltrate the pond waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best.
John, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
I have to start, Jordan, by saying that I think this is a little bit of an unfair question, and I mean that. I came from I spent 25 years in New York City, where food is a whole different culture. So having said that, though, I've been pretty surprised by the number of really fine restaurants in Fresno, particularly in the ambiance mode, right? I rarely get blown away by the food, but I'm often really pleased with the vibe. So there's a couple places I really like. The Annex, which I'm sure everybody would join me in saying is a really fine spot. I go to Quail State quite a bit. I don't find their food so great, but I love the vibe that they're trying to do there. And then don't tell my kids, who are very parochial about New York pizza, but I actually, there's a little brew pub around the corner from my house called South of Shaw. Mm. And they do a prosciutto and fig pizza. I gotta say, I really love it.
I had that last weekend. Yeah, my usual order is the prosciutto and fig, and then the hot honey chicken. Those are kind of the two go-tos. And then it's a wrap for my Friday evening after I consume two of those.
Exactly. Then I roll myself home and it's all over.
Exactly. Well, I'm excited to talk to you about a lot of things. And I kind of want to start by talking about some things in your past before we jump to the Chaffee Zoo. I want to start by talking about the connection in your mind between biology and architecture. Do they have a clear connection for you?
I mean, in retrospect, they do. But I would be lying if I said, like, oh, I had this plan and I made that connection as I moved down these pathways. In terms of like how I got there, it was really just following the muse of intellectual interest, right? And it was only after I was actually, coming to the end of my graduate work in architecture, and I went up to the Bronx Zoo to do some research on a project that had been assigned as part of our design curriculum, that I, before then, like most people, like 90% of people, I had never even thought, oh yeah, exhibits are designed, right? I mean, it's not just like, no. So I went up there and it was, I think I would be exaggerating to say it was a light bulb moment, but certainly it was the start of a realization, which was like, oh, this puts together these disparate elements of my interests in a way that makes me feel really good. And one is, of course, just from an architectural standpoint, the idea of immersive exhibits and the things that go along with that is very theatrical and fun and interesting and sort of like, oh, you're really creating a powerful experience. But at the same time, it's undeniably architectural and practical in many, many ways. The back of a house parts of this are very straightforward and pragmatic. And it's all in the, of course, service of trying to create a message and an experience that people will take away that's bigger than just that moment of being there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're working with animals, you're working with the people that work with animals, you're creating a sense that what you're striving for is preservation of wildlife and wild habitat. So put everything that I love together.
Yeah. I was going to ask you next about what you learned about exhibit design in your work at the Bronx Zoo. Is there anything that stands out to you?
Yeah. It's interesting because I'm actually reading a book right now called A Different Nature. It's by an English zoo director and architect. His name is David Hancock. And he really talks about this because I was incredibly fortunate. I could have started my career in any number of different places and would have enjoyed it and everything else. The Wildlife Conservation Society, which runs the Bronx Zoo and the New York Aquarium, is a very unusual entity within zoos and aquariums in that it's made a journey. Many zoos are on this route, but the Bronx Zoo and a couple of others are way down the road on it, right? Which is, it's made an evolution from a zoo with a conservation program, like many of us have now, to a conservation organization that runs a zoo. And thus the emphasis and the focus and the thought and intentionality that goes into the exhibit design is very different from the very beginning. And I was really fortunate, and again, not planned, to just walk into that as my norm. So I worked with people for whom they had the highest, you know, aesthetic standards on these exhibits and the immersion. And it's incredibly rigorous in that regard. But it was all grounded from the very get-go, as opposed to layered on top with a message, right? It was really brought from everything we were doing was a conservation message, right? And how you would incorporate that into the architecture. And not everybody does that. And that really framed for me as I began more, you know, to get more conscious of how the larger profession was looking at things. It really grounded for me how I wanted to approach that as I had more autonomy in making those kinds of decisions.
Hmm. Can you talk about some of the differences between running a zoo and running an aquarium? I mean, I think in my mind, when I was thinking about it, I was reading about some of the approaches that the Monterey Aquarium has taken to mm-hmm. be kind of in connection with their surroundings. It feels like zoos are kind of more isolated, whereas aquariums are connected to the sea in a way that influences some decision. Are there other differences between running a zoo and running an aquarium?
Well, there are two big ones. And the one which I should get out of the way right up, power goes out and you're running a zoo, it's like, oh, that's inconvenient, right? Maybe some doors don't open or whatever. Yeah. Power goes out and you're running an aquarium, you have the potential for a lot of dead ends.
Yeah.
Right? So that is a major, like, it's just so much more infrastructure heavy. It's so much more dependent on technology in so many ways to run an aquarium than it is a zoo. This kind of an obvious statement, but one worth noting, because it keeps you up in, you know, as an aquarium director, it keeps you up at night in ways that you just don't have those same stresses as a zoo director.
Yeah.
However, I will say, and you just touched on it, my realization as an aquarium director in New York City was that the conservation messaging that can go along with the exhibit building is so much more powerful and relevant to people's lives, because almost everybody is surrounded by aquatic or marine wildlife. And by that, I mean, almost every city, and there are some exceptions, but almost every city was founded on a navigable waterway, which means surrounded by water. If you're surrounded by water, you're surrounded by wildlife. And that is a really interesting and important way to connect people to what we want to do, that many times in zoos, particularly, like, okay, we're in Fresno and we create an incredible Africa, you know, savanna experience. It's still an abstracted experience, right? It's not within the day-to-day possibility of most of the people that come. And in fact, that's some of the power of it, right? I'm showing you something that you rarely have the chance to see on your own. However, if it's an aquarium and you're thinking like, oh, this wildlife actually surrounds me in my day-to-day life, that's a really powerful opportunity, I think, to connect with people on a different level and to be relevant on a different level. And then all of the conservation issues that come out of that, which are a plethora, right? The marine environment is really the contested space for so many conservation issues, from microplastics to rising seas to heating seas to acidifying seas. And the fact that the ocean is our lungs and our engine, really, of so much of the way the world works on a natural, you know, ecosystem basis, like, those are really important and powerful, and therefore great opportunities to connect people and make them think deeply and with a sense of urgency around conservation that can otherwise seem like, oh, that's just going on somewhere else, right?
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about your Ocean Wonders Sharks exhibit. I think one of the favorite lines that I read about it was in the New York Times, they called it sharkitecture, which I thought was a fantastic created word. Can you talk about some of the lessons learned and some of the challenges of making such a large exhibit?
Yeah, well, some of the lessons learned, and they're kind of daunting, especially as we contemplate having some sort of, you know, aquatic or aquarium feature at the zoo. First of all, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier, right? aquariums are just so infrastructure heavy. It's a very specialized construction. You know, you've got holding water and holding corrosive salt water, nonetheless, is just, it's insane on some level, right? So it is really, it is therefore expensive, and it is therefore, you know, time consuming, specialized work. We just outlined why it's still worth that time. So that was definitely one of the lessons I took away from it. It's like, this is no easy thing to do, no matter how wonderful it is, you know, in the aesthetic imagination of architecture. The actual implementation or construction of that is just a challenge that you will never get perfect, right? And I say that, and I've told this to people, so it's no, I'm not revealing any secrets. Every aquarium leaks. Every aquarium leaks at some point in their life, or at some point in the process, or to some extent, every aquarium leaks because it's the nature of water. It doesn't want to be held in place, right? So that is something on a very practical level that you take away from it. But on the sort of more powerful driver of why we're doing what we're doing and why we would take on that expense and that sort of craziness of trying to do something like that, just what you and I were talking about, right? What I could share with people, and especially in a place like New York, and I think it's probably true here in Fresno, you know, the San Joaquin River strikes me as sort of an underutilized, powerful message here in the valley. But, you know, in New York, you never think about New York because it's so many things. You rarely think about it as a maritime city, right? Or as a place in which, you know, is defined by the ocean. And yet, of course, it is the port and everything else. Once you start getting people to think about, like, oh, this is my heritage, right? This is not just an overlay of my life, but actually an under lay of my life. It becomes a really interesting and powerful message maker. And that's where I think that we have the opportunity. I think that, you know, listeners should know that what the next phase of exhibit immersive design that we contemplate here at the Fresno Chaffee Zoo is a California exhibit, right? And that we would like that to end with a California. How can you talk about California without talking about the coast and the ocean and the sort of defining characteristic of this beautiful long coastal state? Well, to do that, I think we can create a connection, which I find really powerful and exciting, between, and especially here in the valley, right, where water is such a contested and contentious issue on so many levels. Creating a, and it is a literal connection between the snowpack in the Sierras and the ocean offshore is like, oh, what a great opportunity, right? To tell a series of linked stories connected by this fundamental resource that we need not just for life, but for our economy, for our quality, and everything else.
Yeah, I really do despise how zero sum our discussions are about water and how we tend to say it's either one story or the other, as opposed to a number of stories about water that are all true at the same time. And so
Agreed.
I think that would be a perfect thing for the valley to have a kind of a place to kind of come together and think about it with a different perspective and think about our environment in a different perspective. Speaking of that, you know, about environments, you changed your environment moving to Fresno from New York. That's a pretty drastic environment change. Can you talk a little bit about what led you to make this decision and kind of push and pull factors?
Yeah, thanks for asking. And also, thanks for saying that about water. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And this is one of the things we take really seriously here at the Fresno Chaffee Zoo, is this idea of our ideal is to be common ground where these conversations can go on in not an either-or situation, right? But rather looking for the ands and looking for the nuance and the subtlety and the connections and the linkages between our interests, as opposed to always seeing them in opposite warring camps, right? And I think conservation in particular, you know, the preservation of habitat and wildlife and resources is one of the most powerful ways in which we can do that, because everybody has a linkage to it in some at some aspect, right? To get to your question about how I wound up here, you have to start with where I started from, which was California. I'm born and raised in California, native Californian, loved California. Growing up, I was born and raised in the San Fernando Valley, but I spent probably the most, you know, shaping time of my life up in Humboldt County. I lived there from the time I was 17 until the time I was 30. And Those of you who know Humboldt County know it's just a naturally incredibly beautiful place from that standpoint of resources. It's defined by the giant redwoods, right? So that's an amazing experience. It's defined by the ocean. There was, up till recently, but when I was there, quite active commercial salmon fishery, commercial crab fishery. It had been, you know, sort of defined historically by lumbering and by dairy industry. So there was just a lot of really rich natural resource based ways of being there. And, you know, it was a college town. It was fantastic. So I didn't leave California like, oh, I got to get out of here. I didn't leave Humboldt County. Oh, I got to get out of here. I left for a number of reasons, and a lot of them kind of tragic, but I wound up in a place where I never thought I would go and was never really trying to go. And I was following love when I did it. My then girlfriend, now, you know, now wife, was in the broadcast news business. And the way you move up in that business is you start in the tiniest little markets. That would be Eureka, California. And as you, you know, build up a portfolio of work, you then move up in markets if you're good. And she was very good. So we wound up going from Eureka, California, with one stop in, you know, for a brief period of time in Burlington, Vermont. We wound up then in New York City, which I was a complete fish out of water, but which I also had just an incredible experience of realizing something that I think people overlook in the urban environment, especially one as dense as New York City, which is it's actually ecologically a pretty sound way to live, right? Where mass transit is realistic, where the density of living there creates these sort of economies of scale that can actually work to the advantage of the ecosystem at large. So I loved New York City, and I'm not one of those people who it's a lot, as you might guess, but it's a lot of great too. But the whole time I was there, and I was there for 25 plus years, the whole time I was there, I was acutely aware subjectively inside of like, I'm an outsider here. I'm actually a Californian, which made my experience there, I think, always one of sort of observing, right, as opposed to inhabiting in some ways, which made it even more powerful in many ways, but was also one in which I was always harboring this idea of like, I want to get back to California. That is my home. That is my place. So after 12 years at the New York Aquarium, we had done a lot of building. It was clear that the organization had sort of maxed out in terms of its ongoing, you know, capital investment in the aquarium for my lifetime anyway. And, you know, I've sort of faced with a choice of, do you want to just be a caretaker here and not really do anything more? And, you know, as an architect, building exhibits, and that's my jam. I was at a personal juncture with my marriage to a woman who I still love very much, but it's clear that we were amicably parting ways within our marriage. My children were adults now. So it was just this sort of last time when I felt like I can go do something for me and for, you know, my professional interests that will work. And I started to sort of look around. I'd been looking around. And the job at Fresno opened up. And I have to tell you, originally I was like, Fresno, Central Valley, I didn't know that much about it. But what I did know, I wasn't like, oh, I can't wait to get there. But as I started the interview process with the board of the Fresno Chaffee Zoo, I was blown away by how much I enjoyed the process with them, how impressed I was with the thoughtfulness that they were bringing to it and the excitement that they had about the future of the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. And of course, you started to get into it. It was like, oh, there's funding, there's public support, everything that I want to do. And they were looking to get, you know, somebody who could lead them in these, you know, avenues of conservation and becoming, you know, a deeper organization. So I found that it worked out. I came here and I, again, blown away from the very get-go by the public support and real deep affection that Fresno County and the Central Valley writ large have for the Fresno Chaffee Zoo. And that is no small thing, I will tell you. And it is, you know, one of the great blessings is to work in that atmosphere, right? Where you feel the support and you feel the interest of the entire, you know, public arena in what you're doing is all positive.
Well, we're happy you're here, and I now have a bunch of questions about actually running a zoo. And
okay.
I want to start by getting you to share kind of what you look for. So if I were to drop you in some zoo across the United States, maybe a mid-level city zoo, and you're walking through the park for the first time and just checking it out, what kinds of things do your eyes naturally gravitate towards? Are there certain things that you look at that would tell you this is a well-run or well-organized zoo?
Yeah, that's a really good question and really well phrased. Yeah, I mean, of course, the first things I look at are the first things that any member of the public look at. And they're the subtle but powerful things of like, oh, it looks clean. The staff seem happy, right? I mean, those things make a big difference. And I think they speak to something deeper going on. So it's not just like, oh, those are those little things. But in terms of the actual zoo itself, the first thing I'm always looking for is how well did they pull off what they intended to do, and how deeply were they thinking about what they intended to do? And, you know, we talked a little bit about it. I'm spoiled or otherwise, you know, biased by my experience with the Wildlife Conservation Society. But for me, what I'm looking at is, did they just build an exhibit and then slap on top of it some story about that exhibit, right? It's like, oh, now you're in Africa, and you know, here's where zebras run, and oh, zebras are, you know, not doing so well or whatever. Or did they have a narrative, a story, an experience they wanted to create, and then they built an exhibit to realize it? And there are sort of two different approaches. The first one, you know, the former, is much more common. You build an exhibit for all sorts of reasons. I have a certain species, or, you know, number of species from a certain zoogeographic region that I think will exhibit really well, or that I need to build new homes for, whatever that may be. Let me do that. Let me get sort of theatrical about it in some way, shape, or form. And some of it not always really well thought out. I sometimes get worried about the way we exoticize, is that a word? You know, certain parts of the world as though they're not, you know, modern urban people with the same kind of issues we have. But nonetheless, you build that, and then it's like, okay, now I got to tell a story. I'll put a few signs up. That's a very different approach from saying, what do I want to say here? And then what are the, you know, the animals in our care that will say, you know, help tell that story most powerfully? What are the relationships between the various species that I'm going to show in this exhibit? And what do I want to say about those relationships in the wild or not, right? And what do I want people walking away thinking, my experience of that made me feel this, and I want to go help that, right? I don't know. I don't mean to sound pretentious or anything else, but I think the meaningful part of what we do has to be the last thing you take away. And that only happens if it's really well integrated into the experience.
Yeah. So I think thoughtful storytelling has a role to play in every organization.
Yeah.
And you can feel when, you know, you can feel when you're around people that seem kind of like hucksters that are just telling you a story that's convenient or, you know, meets the need, or a story that someone deeply believes. And I think you can feel that too in a zoo.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about what it was like during COVID. Obviously you started in 2020, and then that hit you. Was your mindset that this was an opportunity to kind of reset and think about priorities, or was it more just managing the challenges of staffing and keeping the doors open? How did you think about it?
Yeah, I wish I could say I was as strategic as thinking like, oh, okay, here's an opportunity. I think, first of all, a lot of, especially the early stages of it, right, where it was just rolling out, happening fast, and changes were, you know, one day you're open, the next day they're shutting down everything everywhere, and people are just sort of shell-shocked. I think the thing you have to do in any circumstance, but certainly something as sort of profound as what we went through, at least in the early stages, is just, most people are just responding, and that's what everybody was doing, right? It's like, how do I roll with this? But I think the difference maybe is just having a mindset where you're open to whatever may come out of this, right? You're looking for those opportunities. It's not that you're bringing the you know, I have a strategic vision for how to take advantage of this. But as it rolls out, you're thinking about, oh, let's run with this. This is a good, you know, or this is something interesting or otherwise we hadn't thought of. I think there's all sorts of things that a lot of, you know, zoos and aquariums in particular, but all sorts of places took from, you know, things like timed ticketing, things like the ability to have specific experiences handled by smaller number of people, things like that. Education programs going digital and therefore reach, you know, being able to reach more people, thinking about how can we tell stories through digital channels that can be drivers to get people there later, but also in and of themselves, you know, sufficient, necessary and sufficient to telling a great story and educating and engaging and everything else. So I had this put to me by Dean Watanabe, who is my head of education at the time. And it stuck with me. I think it was very powerful. But he said, you know, everything changed when we stopped saying, what should we do for these people? And instead turn around and say, what do you need us to do for you? Right. So if you, because you remember schools, everybody was like, oh my God, we're all remote. Instead of us imposing some, you know, idea or strategy upon them in sort of a profound sense of partnership and humility, saying, how can we help, right? What do you need? What, how can we match up our strengths with your needs? And it was a great, we learned a lot from that. And I think particularly around education, I think particularly around some of the operational issues of moving people in and out, it was a big plus for us.
As a CEO of a zoo, do you care more about how many people visit your zoo a day or how long they spend in the zoo?
Honestly, I'm measuring our sort of metrics of success more on absolute numbers. And the reason is if you think about it, it's a very, there's a lot that goes into a day's visitation, right? And there's many different sort of segments of visitor in that regard. If you're coming, if you drove, you know, an hour from Bakersfield to get there, you're going to get everything you can out of that experience. You're going to be there for 3 hours, maybe even four. You're going to spend a good portion of your day. If you're a member who lives in Fresno and your kids, you know, you're trying to keep the kids cool on a hot, you know, weekend morning or whatever, you might just come in and go to Wilderness Falls for 45 minutes and then leave. And that's okay. You know, both of those things are okay and have their values. If it's a school group, you've got a very, you know, defined set of parameters. You're going to come in at 10 and you're going to leave at 1 because that's what they have to do. So I'm much more aware that, okay, within those segments, everybody's got their place and everybody has a chance to take away something. Repeated short visits are probably just as powerful as one longer visit and vice versa in some ways. So that, you know, I'm always looking at it more from the standpoint of how many people did we get in? Because everybody who comes in for any length of time, I feel like that's our opportunity to get something across. That's our message opportunity.
Yeah. Sometimes people give me grief for my either or questions, but I'm just kind of leading you to explain why it depends. You know, that's usually the answer.
Thank you. It depends.
It depends. Are most zoos designed primarily for families with young kids? And if so, is that a problem?
No. I mean, yes, they are designed that way. And no, it's not a problem.
Okay. Can you explain?
It's not an either or situation, George.
Yeah.
No, it's actually this is one of the most challenging and enjoyable parts of design at a zoo or aquarium is just think of our audience. And you and I have been talking about like, oh, we want to have these conservation messages integrated into the experience. Well, think about our audience. Our audience ranges and, you know, almost in equal chunks, right? Ranges from pre-literate toddlers all the way up to science savvy adults, right? And everybody in between there, right? And they all want to get something from their experience. And some of it is very different, but it's all this great. And they're usually, by the way, coming in a group in which there's also a group dynamic that's going on, right? It's not like you just get them as individuals where you can tailor a message to that slice or segment. So it's such a fun and interesting design challenge to say, how do we make that work for us? And, you know, in some way, and I'll simplify it, but here's an example. If you walk up to an exhibit and you can see an animal. And at the same time, there's some information that we want to get across. And some of that is, here, lift this little lid and find a, you know, some story of a bug underneath a piece of bark. What's it, right? Well, a little toddler is just going to grab that lid and boom, 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 right? But they're learning and thinking and doing all those great tactile, imaginative things that kids do and learning in that way, right? And at the same time, if you're a little bit of an older kid, you might be slowing your little brother or sister down and saying, ooh, look at that bug. Ooh, look at that bug. That bug lives in trees all over the place, right? And at the same time, mom or dad or the caregiver, the adult, maybe reading more and more in-depth information about that and now telling the kid, that's like, hey, Jamal, did you realize that those bugs actually came, are invasive and they came from, right? And they're giving them some powerful information as a trusted, you know, person in their life. So it resonates more, right? Or it has a special resonance at any rate. The adult feels good, right? I just told my kid something really, you know, I have knowledge and I share that. The kid feels great. It's like, oh, I got that knowledge from a trusted source. And everybody's walking away, both getting information at their appropriate level and exchanging that information in a really interesting dynamic. So to play to all that is really challenging, but it's also really fun and satisfying to think about, right? It's like, how are we going to do this? And you almost have to do that with everything that you're doing, because to your point, the audience is children and parents, right? Children and parents. So you can't like leave one side of that out of the equation, or you're just going to have somebody who says like, that was kind of boring.
Yeah. Let's say I took a crane and pulled you out of this job that you're in and dropped you in as the CEO of the local SPCA. Mm. How might your background working in zoos and aquariums affect how you would approach working in an organization that seems like it's kind of on a parallel path, but maybe has some key differences?
Yeah. Well, I will say this. One of the, and this actually doesn't always work within the zoo profession either, but as a biologist, right, my first entree into all of this was through biology and my love of natures and the science aspect of what we do. I generally, and this is true even now, I generally take more of a sort of population approach to the animals in our care, right? And it's not, I think it may be in some ways a weakness, or it just may be what it is, but there are so many passionate, caring people in our profession who are dealing with the animals as individuals, right? Which makes sense. That's human nature in so many ways, that empathy works on the individual basis. So unless you're a science geek, like I tend to be, then you're making those connections as an individual to an individual. And I think that carries over to much of our thinking, and I don't think it always works to our favor, about things like, you know, feral cats and, you know, pet issues, where, you know, it's gone from something that was like you have a pet to now you have a child to now they're out of control. And how do we control them? Because we can't by any means think about them as we would any other kind of population. They're individuals, right? So I don't know. I think I would be a bad director of the SPCA, quite frankly, or one in which I would engender a lot of controversy by thinking about it as a population problem and issue as opposed to a bunch of individuals that we need to take care of, if that makes sense.
Yes. We're going to go ahead and switch gears and jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why.
Good, because I am such a judgmental person by nature. I try to fight it. But Jordan, I will tell you, of course, I think, and like you, if I get this right, I'm constantly going through the world thinking to myself, underrated, overrated.
Yeah, I tend to rate things as well. I'll start with a simple one. Shark Week, over or underrated?
Oh, so overrated.
Okay, explain.
It's a kind of a pet peeve of mine. Thanks for bringing it up. Yeah. Listen, so Shark Week, it's a good example of what we were talking about earlier, right? So Shark Week basically just wants butts in the seats, right? They want people to be scared. They want to play on the ferocity and the like, oh, the alien that's waiting just under the surface to kill you. But then they put this thin veneer because they know they can't do that, right? So they got to pretend like, oh, but we care about sharks, because sharks need our help, by the way. So then they put this thin veneer of like, oh, no, we're just trying to get people to care about you. No, they're not. Overrated.
Okay. Next one, Me and Ed's Pizza.
Can I say? I can't say because I know I should have, but I have not yet had a Me and Ed's
You've
Pizza.
Not yet had? Okay. Well,
no, I know.
We'll make that happen. We'll make that happen.
Hey, Jordan, no.
It's okay. With south of Shaw so close, I get why. Next one, petting zoos, over underrated.
I think they're underrated in terms of their potential. I think they're overrated in terms of the way they've been executed thus far.
Yeah.
I think we could do so much more with kids than just say like, oh, go pet an animal, right? I think kind of some of the things we talked about before, but I think there's a richness and a depth and an information exchange that could happen there that we rarely actually do well in those petting zoos.
Okay. Next one, the original Jurassic Park movie, over underrated. It's a movie about a zoo in some ways, right?
No, I know, trust me. I'm going to say underrated only because what's so interesting to me, not only because it was a good movie, it's, you know, filled with fun, interesting, scary moments. But what's so interesting, of course, is how prescient it was in many ways, right? Because that was just at the dawn when we were really starting to get down into, you know, genetics and this sort of molecular level DNA work that we can do. And of course, now that is just redefined really our approach to so many things within the natural world. But, you know, this whole rewilding, the idea of bringing back extinct species, this has gone from the realm of the science fiction or, you know, action movie like Jurassic Park to a real thing, quite frankly.
Okay. The next one's an either or. Jane Goodall or E.O. Wilson?
E.O. And, which is no knock on Jane, but I just think Dr. Wilson, who I by the way, I had a chance to actually meet on several occasions, just ranged so widely over, you know, the realm of biology, ecology, or as he would put it, you know, sociobiology or biophilia. And I think he was really influential in that range, right? No matter where he was, whether he was just doing his basic work on ants, right? All the way up to, was he thinking about our intrinsic connection with nature and what's the genetic basis for that? I just think he was beyond the pale.
Next one, safari park zoos like the one in San Diego. Do we need more of those?
You know, I think they're overrated. I think there is something about that experience that most of them, you know, base it on, which is the car safari, right? You get in a vehicle, whether it's theirs or yours, and you drive through and you see them. I get it. And I think there's, I know it can be done really well, in which case it's great. But for the most part, I think it's just, there's a distancing from nature that goes on by saying like, I'm already in this modern conveyance, you know, we all know it's fake, whatever.
Okay. Next one's an either or, lions or tigers.
I love all my children, Jordan. Okay. I'm going to say tigers, and I don't do it lightly. Lions are amazing, and lions actually are mind-blowing, powerful, impressive. A male lion up close is just something that can be life-changing. But tigers, they're just so cool. They're the uber cat, right? Because they're solitary, they're incredibly like ferocious. You know, you scaled up your sort of, you know, pet kitty to a size that's just mind-boggling. They're so beautiful in and of, you know, just the striking pattern and everything else. Yeah, I just like them.
Okay. Next one, Nathan's Famous Hot Dogs.
You're really going to get me in trouble here, Jordan, because, yeah. You know, I worked on Coney Island for so many years, and Nathan's defines Coney Island, but they're really as a hot dog, not as a historical artifact of a time gone by, as a hot dog on the current, overrated.
Do you think Disney movies have had a negative or positive impact on the way people view animals?
I think it's pretty harsh to say positive or negative, but and what I mean by that is, I don't think you can go wrong by creating a situation or a circumstance of empathy for wildlife. What they have done, and I think it's an irony of the whole thing, and it goes on well beyond, I mean, this is a very, very deep question or issue, which is, it's really one of the most stunning cases of ideology at work, right? Which is, in some ways, we're portraying nature, but it's always as this thing that we control, shape, you know, or responds to us, even in a paternalistic way, right? They can't exist without our help or whatever. There's very little or few moments that are about respecting an animal for its essential nature as an animal, as opposed to some, you know, emotional surrogate for a human being or equivalent. And I think that viewpoint, that way of looking at the natural world, that way of creating an other, right, from us, is really interesting, right? That in saying, oh, you're just like a little furry human, in some ways, you're really othering them more than you would if you just acknowledge the fact. It's like, oh, you have a rich, full existence as a thing that doesn't need to be compared to humans because it is complete, wonderful, and marvelous as itself, this perfectly adapted thing that it is. So, yeah, I would just say, and it is worked then to make us always, or to force so much of our perspective on nature and wildlife and preservation and conservation of these things through a paternalistic lens as opposed to an intrinsic value lens, right?
Okay, so we're going to jump into some questions specifically about animals. You know, the old saying about 20% of your clients take 80% of your time. And so yeah. I guess in that respect, what takes more time to maintain, a couple large animals or a bigger group of smaller animals?
Well, it depends very much on the habits and social, you know, like, okay, here's an example. So meerkats, they come out, you know, you've seen the Disney movies and they're cool little animals. They're very, very like tied into a social structure though, right? They don't really exist comfortably outside of this very much interwoven social structure. But the truth is you can't, so because they're so tightly socialized into a group, it's often family-based or whatever, but it gets to a certain point and it starts to split off like many colonies do. You can't just throw them together you can't just swap meerkats around. So it becomes like you have to tiptoe through or work within the realistic limitations of this very, very tight social dynamic. It makes it really complicated for these little guys that otherwise it's just like, well, let's put a dozen meerkats in that exhibit and fill it up and make it look great, right? So I would say it's not so much size, because elephants, by the way, interestingly enough, provide many of the same kinds of questions. Like you have, you know, a great deal of what goes into modern elephant care is the sort of support and cultivation of that very important social component of elephant life, right? And again, you can't just throw them together, or if you do, you're going to have problems. And at the same time, there's so many, you know, truths about modern management of all these things where, you know, genetic diversity and everything else, you really need to be able to move animals around. So it's a whole nother layer of thoughtfulness and nuance and complexity that goes into caring for these animals when you start dealing with the entirety of their lives, right? Rather than just like, well, you know, he got what he likes to eat. What else do we have to worry about? So it's not size. I would say social complexity, because obviously a solitary animal, always easier no matter what, right? Because you go, well, we got one of them. Social dynamics.
That makes sense to me. I find that people often misjudge the intelligence of an animal. They base it a lot of on external characteristics. What's an animal that you have at the Chaffee Zoo that maybe people don't assume has a high level of intelligence, but through the work that you guys do, you've found to be extremely intelligent?
I think this might come across as a cop-out, but all of them. It's just, I mean, it touches on what we were saying before, right? If you're judging animals solely through the lens, when you say intelligence, if that is a stand-in for human cognition, right, then, you know, okay, primates, a few other species, you know, notably cetaceans, elephants, maybe, but that's just such a limited and quite honestly distorting lens to look at the perfection of intelligence within the parameters of what it is supposed to, you know, what it can be used for by that. I just mean being perfectly adapted is less about our exclusively human cognitive skills and more about being perfect unto yourself, unto itself, perfectly designed, as it were, or adapted for its life. So, you know, I mean, take it apart. the eyes of a raptor, you know, the ears of a cat, anything like that, you know, you just, it's like, it would just, it's a, again, it's just sort of a distorting mirror where we always have to look at it through a reflection of ourselves. And what I would like more and more for people to do is appreciate, admire, respect, and try to, you know, preserve the wild populations of animals because they are themselves, not because they are some reflection or distortion of humanity.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And the book that informed this for most for me was Ed Young's book, An Immense World, that looked at the different animal senses and how they visualize the world, and showing the kind of like neuro, because we have neurodiversity. That's something that's entered our discourse now for humans. But I think, you know, seeing the way that animals see the world, I think could be really helpful, because it can, it's both alien because it feels strange to see a different way that something senses the world, a different form of intelligence. But it's also just this amazing new world that you can discover by trying to look through an animal's eyes and try to understand the differences. So, yeah, I think you're right on
and
there.
There's also the sort of humility that comes from realizing the limitations to what we can even know. And by that, I mean, it's like, oh, because it's better than us in some ways, right? And it's almost beyond. Thomas Nagel, a philosopher, wrote a very, very influential essay called What It's Like to Be a Bat. And a bat was a perfect example, right? Because bats are so far away from our human experience, right? They live in sonar, they fly. Yeah, you know, it's just, it's almost, you know, beyond our, but that's the whole thing. It's almost beyond what we can imagine. And there is a humility and a incredible sort of opening of appreciation that comes from realizing it's like, oh, bats are just amazing. They're far beyond humans on some level, in some way, in some, you know, way of thinking. And I think if we brought more of that humility and less of that, like, you know, human, you know, that sort of hierarchy, humans and then everything else, we would be in so much better shape with the natural world.
Are there any animals that we don't have at the Chaffee Zoo that you'd be really excited to bring to Fresno?
Yeah. And I don't know that we ever will, but we certainly have talked about it. You know, we earlier on, Jordan, we talked about our next phase with Fresno Chaffee Zoo is to create this California experience from the Sierras to the sea. Well, there is a deep and profound level of symbolic opportunity here, because of course the state symbol of California, it's on our flag, it's everywhere, is the California grizzly. And oh, what an irony, is our state symbol, this thing of all that we aspire to, ferocity, beauty, all, et cetera, power, courage, grace, has been extinct for 100 years. We drove that animal into extinction. And not to pass judgment on that, because that was a different world, a different time, and a different way of relating to wildlife and animals. But it is an opportunity to say, but do we have to keep thinking about our relationship with wildlife that way, through that lens, either or, right? Us or them. And the truth is, having a California grizzly is in our California exhibit, if we can do it, would be an amazing way to talk about not just this powerful, beautiful, amazing apex predator that is a grizzly bear, but also about our relationship, both past, present, and thinking about what it might be in the future with wildlife, and about the way we could create a new way of thinking about that dynamic. So definitely California grizzly is one that I would be really excited for all sorts of reasons.
Fantastic. Growing up, I would get up in the morning and go sit with my dad on the couch, and I would always grab the same book from a bookshelf we had in our living room, and it was a giant animal atlas. And I would read it every morning. I would go through the pages one at a time, and my parents always told me that there was a page that was leafed over the most, and it had a Komodo dragon on it. And I just mainly loved it because it had the word dragon in it, and I thought those things didn't exist. But then I saw one, I was like, oh, there are dragons. And I bring that up because you have a wonderful new exhibit, Kingdom of Asia. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about the thoughts behind the design of that exhibit and what you hope people take away from it when they visit.
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say your story was very moving because those are my childhood memories as well. And they set me on a path that, you know, is here now. But
yeah,
those books, that utter fascination and, you know, being enthralled by not only animals, but by information about animals is something I think about all the time in our work now, right? I mean, that little kid that I was, that you were in those moments, is still the little kid that I know is having the time of their lives at every visit to the zoo. So it was like, what an incredible responsibility and also great joy. Kingdoms of Asia is a really interesting, and I want to just be as frank as I can in this conversation about Kingdoms of Asia. It is a beautiful exhibit and it turned out incredible. It was designed before I arrived at Fresno Chaffee Zoo. In fact, I arrived almost simultaneously with groundbreaking of construction. So done, baked as far as the design goes.
Yeah.
And it is one that, if I am being completely honest, I don't think I would have ever designed had I been in on that process. And it's not because it's beautiful and it's, you know, it came out great, but I'm so worried about the potential for, so if you, for those of the listeners who haven't been, Kingdoms of Asia is at least in part sort of based on this sort of surrounding narrative of Angkor Wat and other temples of Southeast Asia that have been this sort of back and forth between nature and human civilization over time. It's a really interesting dynamic. It's a really interesting idea, but it's also, I mean, but we're talking about profound cultural and religious iconography. And for me, here in a Western setting, you know, the potential for doing that in a way that was either, you know, misappropriating or inadvertently disrespectful, at the very least kind of simplistic, is just so big that I would be very, very worried about doing that. But I will tell you something, and it was, you know, I take this away because, first of all, as it turns out, you know, my sort of wokeness around this, if you will, I hate to use that word, but, you know, my concerns from that, as that through that lens, turned out not to be the case. And I'll tell you why. It's because early on in that exhibit, because we were dealing with this very profound cultural story, as well as the wildlife that we typically do, we brought in advisors from the Southeast Asian community here in the Central Valley, which was amazing for a number of reasons. First of all, they gave us real and significant feedback at every step of that realization of the design, right? And their feedback both changed it, but also gave us the confidence that what we were doing was appropriate, right, and you know, representing it correctly, which was a huge, you know, confidence boost. But also the other thing that it did was build a relationship with the community of Southeast Asian immigrants here in the Valley, which, as you know, is a very significant one, and give us a chance to integrate their story and their journey into the actual exhibit itself, because that's a really important aspect of this, right? The relationships between wildlife and humanity. I mean, we should tell both of those. But it was also like incredibly moving to me as we got towards the completion of this exhibit to have not only the advisors, but so many people from the Southeast Asian community when they would come to visit the zoo and go through that exhibit and tell me sincerely, it means so much to us that this exhibit is here telling our story because no one has told our story before. No one has, you know, given our unique cultural existence here in the Valley its full due. And these are our neighbors. These are our friends. These are our coworkers. And so the idea that we could do that along with telling the story of the wildlife and telling the story of those interactions, that we could represent that culture in a respectful and appropriate way, turned out to me to be like, oh, everything I was worried about, if you are thoughtful and you do it right and you're trying to be careful, you can not only do it right, you can do it better, right? And you can actually I think the exhibit is so much more powerful for that engagement of the cultural community. And it's so much better as a conservation story. So that was great.
Yeah. My last question before we get to books is a question I ask everybody. I work in education, and that particular vantage point gives me a unique perspective on the problems, solutions, and, you know, the makeup of a city. I'm curious how your work at the zoo informs the way you see Fresno.
The way it, I mean, one of the things that, again, you know, coming from the outside, I did not grow up in the Central Valley. I grew up in California. And so I was ready for, or I had my preconceptions about certain things. Coming to the Central Valley and realizing, besides all the challenges, right? We all know there's a great deal of economic challenges here. There are water resource challenges, all the political issues, et cetera. I was not fully cognizant of the incredible, varied and rich diversity of the people living in the Central Valley, right? We just talked about the Southeast Asian community, but you could name 10 other communities that are significant here in the Valley. And I had no idea. Okay, it's a bunch of, you know, Anglos and Latinos. So I just find that to be such an incredible opportunity that we can, and we talked about this earlier too, right? This, everybody loves the zoo. That's such an incredible opportunity for us to be good neighbors, and not just good neighbors in the sense like, oh, everybody's passively invited to the zoo, I hope you have a good time, but good neighbors in terms of actually getting out and making sure that people are actively invited to the zoo, that people who have never felt like that was a part of their opportunity, we make it their opportunity. And that being able to do that, I think, starts to, I don't want to overstate it, it doesn't mend anything, but I think it does help a little bit mitigate or facilitate closing some of those gaps that are all over, you know, educational attainment, everything that we know to be true here in the Valley and in the county. I think we have an opportunity to be a positive force for the better there. And I don't want to be pretentious, and I don't want to overstate what a zoo can do, but I do think when people see themselves in a place, when they see their own future in a place, and especially for us, if we're speaking about like, well, we honestly want to save the world, and how the heck are we going to do that if everybody doesn't want to get on board with that or see themselves as, you know, important in that struggle? I think we can both do the right thing and do it for the right reasons in a way that maybe not everybody can.
I mean, I agree with you. I think we, you know, a book that was formative for me is called Bowling Alone. And it was about the loss of a lot of our civic institutions.
Civic life, right.
And I think the zoo is kind of, you know, it's not a civic institution in that way, like a Rotary Club or something, but it is something where it's non-denominational. Mm-hmm. It's accessible to everybody. It's something that no matter your background, you understand what it is and can relate to it. And so I think it does serve as a crux or a central point in a community, given the loss of a lot of these institutions we have. So I agree with you 100%. I think it does have a central role in Fresno, for sure.
I appreciate you saying that. I've had people, and this was eye-opening to me because, of course, I'm always thinking, you know, oh, we're telling a conservation story to save wildlife. I've had so many people in the zoo who are very supportive of the zoo and very supportive of what we're doing tell me that what they primarily like about the zoo is that it is a family-oriented activity, outdoor activity, that doesn't, that they don't see that possibility, you know, so many of those possibilities, just what you're saying, right? The areas in which we used to have those forums all the time are becoming fewer and fewer, and the zoo therefore stands out more and more, not only in the excellence that we do it, but just that we still do it, right? That we are still a family-oriented outdoor activity. It's really awesome.
We always close in the same place with books. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I mentioned one earlier, right? This a book by David Hancock's called A Different Nature. It's the paradoxical world of zoos and their uncertain future. And he's really just talking about this journey that we've been on as a profession. The things that we used to do are kind of, you know, not so, honestly, they're a little embarrassing, but the things that we are trying to do, the ways we're trying to evolve, I think are really eye-opening to people, because too many people are still thinking back in the 50s, 60s, or 70s about zoos instead of in the 2020s and beyond, right? So there's that. I just read a really good book, and I think actually, Jordan, you would appreciate this because I know that you are a fan of history and a deep reader. I read a book by a guy, Guy McLean Rogers, called Alexander, The Ambiguity of Greatness, which I thought was really, really interesting because it is a new one. You know, we always try to bucket things into, like you and I were talking about, either or, right?
Yeah.
And it's usually and Alexander the Great was both an incredible statesman as well as soldier, but also a guy who's just, he was, you know, terrible on many levels, right? In ways that we wouldn't even imagine today. I found that really interesting. I just started James McBride's new book, which I'm really excited about, the grocery store. I literally just picked it up. It's called
The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store.
Heaven and Earth Grocery. Thank you, George.
Yes, yes, yes.
Anyway, I'm very excited about that because I actually love James McBride. The Good Lord Bird was a fantastic book. His biography, The Color of Water, was an amazing book. I've always really liked his stuff, so I'm super psyched to pick this up. I heard him talk about it, and he was saying that he actually wrote it to reimagine the life of his grandmother, who he said had a loveless marriage and was unhappy. And one of the great things about fiction is to be able to rewrite reality. And I thought that's just a brilliant and generous thing to do. And what a loving thing, what a loving gift to give. So I'm excited about all of those. I would close on my most pretentious note only because my son, who graduated with his degree in philosophy, is constantly challenging me in ways in which I honestly wish he would stop. But he's challenged me to read Schopenhauer's The World as Will and Representation.
Oh, God.
I am all of 15 pages into it, and I am struggling to stay not only with it, but awake. So, hey, I'm recommending that to your viewers as an insomnia aid.
There you go. That's perfect. Well, we're on the precipice of summer. What are some things that are in store for people at the Chaffee Zoo that you're excited about over the next couple months?
Yeah, well, we just are weeks away, and by that I mean a couple of weeks away, from opening the last portion of Kingdoms of Asia. It was the sort of a piece, the old elephant and rhino exhibit that had been overlooked in the initial design. We went back and picked that up. We're going to have Malayan tapirs, babirusa, which are a really interesting species of Asian pig and wild pig, and then muntjac, which are these tiny little Asian deer that are about fox terrier size, and they got little fangs and they bark like fox terriers. So we're going to open that up in a couple of weeks, and that's going to be very cool. I'm very excited about that. It'll be the sort of finishing touch in Kingdoms of Asia. We are bringing back Valley Farm. You had mentioned Petting Zoo earlier. I think we're doing a good job of trying to give all the fun and interaction of the petting zoo with kids, you know, actually being able to get hands-on with domestic animals, but trying to give a little bit more story about the centrality of agriculture in the Central Valley and our own history here and the power, both as an economic driver and the place where so many people's histories intersect. So that should be a lot of fun. And I think that's going to be actually pretty nice for something that we just thought would be a refresh. I think it's going to be pretty powerful. And then lastly, we just opened, although we're still putting on some of the explanatory signage, something we call the Center for Conservation Action, or Conservation Action Center, excuse me, which is where we are the home for our blunt-nosed leopard lizard propagation program. The blunt-nosed leopard lizard is a species endemic to the Central Valley. So endemic meaning it lives nowhere else on Earth. It was one of the original species on the Endangered Species Act back in the 70s. So it has been endangered and ever more so for decades now. It is really the populations here in the valley, the last remaining populations are in danger of blinking out entirely. We're in danger of losing this animal. So Fresno Chaffee Zoo partnered with the Bureau of Land Management, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Fresno State to bring in some of these animals, start a captive breeding program, and now we are reintroducing those animals into the wild. So it's a great opportunity for people to see the work that goes on behind the work, to know that we are indeed working to make a difference, and that it's not always, or even perhaps most importantly, about the charismatic megafauna out there, elephants, tigers, bears, whatever you might think of, but the web of life and the way in which when we change habitat, we lose so much. And if we restore populations or habitats, so much could be gained. So it's great. That's exciting.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Last question. I remember last time we talked, I mentioned that I would love a rooftop bar at the top of the lodge so you could listen to the lions roar at night. How close are we to that?
Hang in there, Jordan. We'll, you know, with this California, the great thing is going into something as complex and really rife with potential as this new California experience. We've learned so much, and it's not rooftop bar necessarily, but the idea of having integrated event space, right, where people can come in. We do so many community events now where we're really trying to get our neighbors in to celebrate culture, but you don't want to block aisles or whatever that may be. So I think there's going to be so many chances to integrate these other experiences that sometimes seem collateral, but really could be central to a visit to the zoo in the most positive ways. And certainly a rooftop bar should be one of those.
Fantastic. I love that that's your response. Well, I will work on getting you a Me and Ed's pizza, and thank you for the work that you're doing at the Chaffee Zoo.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
If Me and Ed's is listening out there, it's not a knock on your pizza. I would love to have your pizza.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.